Well, I'm going to introduce you to what could be the real-life Indiana Jones, Giorgio Tsoukalos. He's a trailblazer, changing the way the world thinks about the ancient astronaut theory. Now, for more than 12 years, Giorgio has been the director of Eric von Däniken's Center for Ancient Astronaut Research. He is the publisher of the legendary Times magazine, the world's only and definitive ancient astronaut research journal. Giorgio has traveled the world extensively, and today is one of the few people who have actually visited and explored nearly all the mysterious places our planet has to offer. Full show right now with Giorgio Tsoukalos. Giorgio, how are you again?
Very well. Thank you very much, George. I'm glad to be back on the show.
Always a pleasure to have you. What have you been doing lately?
Well, I've actually been very, very busy. I consider myself very blessed. And as you know, but I would like to share this with our listeners, back in 2009, I was consulting producer of a little television show called Ancient Aliens.
Little, I have had more response to that little television show, Giorgio.
It's a bit of an understatement, isn't it?
You did a great job on that.
But we are, in fact, currently filming Ancient Aliens, the series. And we just filmed you a few weeks ago. And we're in the process of putting everything together. We're almost in post-production. And the show will air on the History Channel, 5 episodes, starting this April. So anyone that's listening, please tune in to the History Channel in April. It's called Ancient Aliens, the series, and in most likelihood it will be aired on Saturday nights.
So obviously, now
you finally have something to do on Saturday.
Obviously, the History Channel liked what you did on that first show.
Well, it was, you know, the idea was always to sort of write a love letter to Chariots of the Gods, which was Eric's seminal work back in 1970. And, you know, I mean, you've seen the program, and I'm sure many, many of Coast to Coast listeners have watched the program as well. And this was truly one of the first programs ever that put the ancient astronaut theory in a positive light and you know, presented in a way that it's downright conceivable that, you know, we're aware ourselves that most of the stuff we talk about sounds completely off the wall. But if you look at it from a, you know, scientific perspective, then after a while, after digging through the surface, you have to come to the conclusion that, yes, something happened in our remote past. And, of course, in the ancient astronaut theory, it means that Earth has been visited by extraterrestrials in the remote past.
Yeah, I had an opportunity, Giorgio, to talk with Eric von Däniken on the program several months ago.
Wonderful.
And he
told me about it.
He has as much energy now as he had when his Chariot of the Gods book came out decades ago.
And he's 75 years old. He's 75 years old right now, and he is writing book number 31. And Career Press just announced that his latest book, Twilight of the Gods, will be published here in the United States in July of this year. So all very exciting. I mean, History is Wrong was his last book that he published in English. That book did really well. But, you know, someone who has already read his book, Twilight of the Gods, which is called Götterdämmerung in German, someone who's already read that, like me, I can tell you it blows most all of his books out of the water because it's absolutely ironclad. And, you know, it's very, very well researched and just magnificent. So everyone should just look forward to it. It's going to be amazing.
We're going to give people one ride tonight. But before we get into this journey, tell me a little bit more about you, Giorgio, how you got interested in the ancient astronaut theory, how you and Eric got together, where you and I are the director of the Center for Ancient Astronaut Research, how that all happened for you.
Well, that actually, you know, the interest in the, you know, the alternative history of mankind has basically been instilled on me since I was a child growing up in my home, because especially my grandma, she was very much tuned in into all these subjects. And for example, I've had the privilege to travel all around the world with my parents, who were avid travelers, and they made sure that we would go to all the museums and all the archaeological sites, you know, just as a real life education on site, this and that. But whenever I would come home, my grandma would say, look, now you've learned these particular mainstream ideas of this site and that site, but let me show you something else. And so she would read to me, books by Eric or books by anyone, you know, the unsolved mysteries of the world. So that type of discussion at my home was dinner table stuff. And especially also my mom, she's always said, and I never quite understood as a little child what she meant by this, but of course as you grow older, you change, your brain grows, and you understand what she meant. And what she basically said was that everything that exists today, like technology-wise, she always said that she thinks that all of this has already existed before at some point in time. And I never knew what she meant. And today we laugh about it because, you know, both of my parents are, you know, they're doctors and all this. And so I'm the only non-doctor, non-attorney, non-engineer, non-whatever in my entire family.
But you're having fun.
I'm having a lot of fun. But I'm always saying to my parents, I'm saying, look, it's your fault. You talked to me about this when I grew up.
That's
so,
right.
You know, just don't say anything.
You know, my mother did the same thing to me. My father wanted me to become a dentist. She would bring me books that Walter Sullivan, the late New York Times science writer, wrote called We Are Not Alone. She'd pull out Look magazine when they had the Benny and Barney Hill interrupted journey story. So, she got me into all this, too. And I told her just a few weeks ago, I said, Mom, you're the reason I'm doing what I'm doing today. Dad wanted me to be a dentist.
And this is why, after all, we can definitely be grateful to our parents and our grandparents, because we're definitely a product of the environment that we grew up in. And, we're testament to this.
Well, and I've made them both happy, Giorgio. One, I'm doing this program, which she adores. Two, I go to the dentist twice a year for my dad. Everybody wins, right?
Exactly.
Tell me a little bit about the stories of creation, because that's important to get into everything we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, and that is really a great question to start off with, because here's the very interesting idea or concept of the ancient astronaut theory, and it basically suggests that a long, long time ago, extraterrestrials visited the Earth in the remote past. And so it doesn't matter what ancient culture you look at, all of those cultures have what's considered a creation story. And what's really interesting, regardless if the story comes from the east, from the west, from the north, or from the south, all creation stories at their core are literally identical, because what you have there is that everything starts in complete darkness. And out of this complete darkness, or sometimes also referred to as the chaos or the deep dark void, a type of egg or a cosmic egg emerges from far, far away. Sometimes the egg is referred to as being silver in color. Sometimes it's referred to as being golden in color. And that egg then descends onto Earth. And when the egg then cracks open and there is this bright light that emanates from it, and from there all creation begins. Now, not all these eggs crack open. Sometimes a heavenly ladder descends or is lowered from these cosmic eggs, out of which these heavenly teachers descend and teach mankind in all sorts of different disciplines. Now, we all know that cosmic eggs in that sense do not exist. So the question that I ask is, well, what did our ancestors mean when they talked about these cosmic eggs? And, you know, so we have references to cosmic eggs. We also have references to cosmic pearls, cosmic turtles, mm-hmm. cosmic snakes, winged snakes, flying shields, and flaming shields. So, and if you look at it from a very rudimentary point of view, all those shapes are pretty much identical or similar. I mean, a turtle can be compared to an egg. So what is it that our ancestors tried to describe or circumscribe what they saw or witnessed or what their ancestors witnessed so that it was compelling enough for them to put it in writing or into their traditions? Because at the outset of this program, I would like to state very clearly that our ancestors had the same brains that we have today, which means they were as intelligent as we are today. The only difference is that their technological frame of reference was different than what we have today. So therein lies the difference. Our ancestors were not stupid. On the contrary, they were as smart as we are today. However, when they got in contact with flesh and blood extraterrestrials, they did not comprehend the nuts and bolts aspects behind those visits and thus turn it into something spiritual, something divine, right, something magical. Even though, by the way, you know, I mean, I do not deny the spiritual world or the divine. Of course not. I am a deep believer in God. Of course, then the question is, you know, what is your idea of God? I mean, it's certainly not anything out of the Old Testament, for example. But so that's a whole other discussion.
That's another show.
Yeah, so there we have all these different creation stories that in and of itself are identical. And when, you know, scientists, mainstream scientists come along and say, well, you know, all of this is just fantasy, it's all just invented stories, you know, that to me is an insult in the face of our ancestors.
Well, I agree with you, Giorgio, because let's say 50 years ago, if you put an iPhone in front of somebody 50 years ago, they would have no idea what it was.
Exactly.
But they would try to describe it the best way they could, and they'd come up with something in that if people looked back 50 years from then, right around now, let's say, and we read that description, we'd say, boy, that's pretty weird, you know, how they tried to come up with it, what they tried to explain.
Absolutely, and that is what is so fascinating, that in biblical times, we actually have references of magical glowing stones with which people were able to see the world and with which people received teachings. What were our ancestors describing? Did magical glowing stones really exist? Or if you place a laptop or, like what you just said, an iPhone in front of someone who has never seen something like this and, you know, propel yourself back 5,000 years and you have, you know, you bring a laptop with you, that laptop would become a magical tablet. And then imagine you put a DVD and you play a scene from the Grand Canyon on that. Well, I mean, that is just astonishing to whoever sees this 5,000 years ago. And thus we create a story that later then is relegated into the realm of fantasy, which it never was.
Giorgio, let's talk a little bit about Genesis. And again, here's another episode of what could have been an interpretation of ancients for what they saw. Explain.
Well, of course. I mean, and of course, Genesis, and I'm sure that many of our coast-to-coast listeners are very familiar with this, and that is the fact that if we read Genesis, then there is one particular sentence in there that says, and then God created man in their image. And grammatically speaking, that sentence really doesn't make any sense. And of course, as theologians are saying that, you know, the there in that sentence has to do with the Holy Trinity and all this stuff. But if you look at it from the original perspective, when you look at the word God, then in the original Hebrew, the word for God is Elohim. And Elohim, and any, you know, true scholar, if they were to translate that word correctly into correct English, the word Elohim is a plural form. It means the gods. So then, if you rewrite that sentence, the sentence correctly would have to read, and then the gods created man in their image. So that is one of the basic tenets of the ancient astronaut theory, that a long, long time ago, some flesh and blood extraterrestrials arrived on Earth and saw that sensible, intelligent life, humanoid life, exists here on Earth. And in order to bring us to the next phase of development, they conducted a genetic mutation of our genes and thus created Homo sapiens sapiens. Because one thing is crystal clear that, you know, the fossil record exists. There is no denial in that. But something happened because there was a quantum leap when we were literally munching bananas in caves, and then all of a sudden we're building civilization.
Yeah, all of a sudden we're pretty intelligent, aren't
yes.
we?
Yes, and so that is what even Charles Darwin referred to. Look, Charles Darwin in his Origin of Species himself said, I like my theory, and I have to agree with him. You know, a lot of stuff that he wrote in Origin of Species is great. However, even he himself said, but something I can't wrap my mind around, and that is why today we have the infamous missing link. And that missing link is where there is no transitional period between any of the previous humanoid species, none of our human ancestors, that, you know, they all just appeared and disappeared. There is no transitional form. And so the ancient astronaut theory is that particular missing link, which suggests that, you know, everything happened due to a targeted mutation of our genes in the remote past. And the crazy thing is that, you know, the intelligent design people out there who are studying this are, you know, we're living in very exciting times right now. The geneticists have translated our human genome, our DNA has been translated.
Sure.
So, you know, both sides, the traditional scientists and the intelligent design people, they are looking at something in genetics, in our human DNA, where something doesn't make sense. And unfortunately, the scientists, they're trying to explain everything away with Darwinism, and the intelligent design people are trying to explain everything away with God. Well, you see, there actually should be a reconciliation of the two, and somewhere in the middle we should meet, and that the missing link, or God, wasn't necessarily God. God is a spiritual entity, who, by the way, does exist, but that it was an extraterrestrial interference of our genes in the remote past. And I think that one day we will find that answer, because it won't be a monument, it won't be a crashed spaceship or something, but I think that the message will be ultimately found in our genes. And to be honest with you, not to be a conspiracy theorist or anything.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm on the right program for this.
Yes.
But what if that knowledge has already been discovered in the lab? Who knows?
That's very possible. Your two websites, legendarytimes.com, legendarytimesbooks.com. We've got you linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Do you travel much when you do this research?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you see, that is one thing that the you know, members and also the researchers of the Center for Ancient Astronaut Research can pride themselves in, that we actually go to the places that we write about, because unfortunately we live in the time of Photoshop.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you've got to get there. Giorgio, hold on for just a bit. We're going to be right back with you in just a moment. And I want to get into the possibilities of atomic bombs being used in ancient times. This is a fascinating program. Our special guest tonight, Giorgio Tsoukalos, as we talk about the ancient astronaut theory. And there's much more, by the way. We'll talk about Native American Thunderbirds later on Coast to Coast AM. Giorgio, tell us a little bit about the theory of the possibility of an atomic war, an ancient atomic war.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely one of the tentpoles of the ancient astronaut theory, because in ancient Indian texts, we have concise references of, looked at from a modern perspective, would suggest some type of an atomic explosion or atomic explosions, plural, actually. And, you know, the debunkers are saying that all of this is nonsense, because in battle there are explosions, big explosions. And, you know, to be honest with you, my reaction to that argument is, okay, these texts are, you know, 4,000 years old, that they, according to mainstream archaeology, really have explosions back then. And that is to, you know, that is up for debate, but I'm leaning more towards the idea that no, they didn't. Nothing that was created by man or by humankind anyhow. However, there are descriptions, and I've actually prepared a quote here from the Mahabharata. And what the debunkers are not looking at is the greater picture, because, you know, they're only fixating on one aspect of the story, and then they're ignoring all the rest. And those descriptions are very detailed. So this is a few lines, so I'm just going to read it, but this is out of the Mahabharata, and it says that he hurled a single projectile charged with all the power of the universe, an incandescent column of smoke and flame as bright as a thousand suns rose in all its splendor. A perpendicular explosion with its billowing smoke clouds, the cloud of smoke rising after its first explosion, formed into expanding round circles. It was an unknown weapon, an iron thunderbolt, a gigantic messenger of death, which reduced to ashes the entire race of the Rishnis and the Andakas. The corpses were so burned as to be unrecognizable.
Amazing.
Their hair and nails fell out. Pottery broke without apparent cause, and the birds turned white. After a few hours, all their food was infected. To escape from this fire, the soldiers threw themselves in streams of water to wash themselves and their equipment. Now, I'm sorry, George, there are multiple references in here that speak directly of something that would have to do with a nuclear blast, because only if you suffer from radiation poisoning or from nuclear fallout do your nails fall out.
How old was that text, Giorgio?
About 2,000 to 3,000 years old, and this is from ancient India. And you see, and you know, if you read about a pillar of smoke, and you know that the smoke or the explosion formed into expanding round circles, you know, I mean, that is a mushroom cloud, and you know, there are all these other things, like, you know, that the soldiers threw themselves into streams of water to clean themselves. That's what you have to do after you come in contact with any type of radioactivity.
Absolutely. I mean, how clear can it be? It sounds like an obvious description to some kind of atomic attack. Now, who did it exactly and why? That's another story, isn't it?
Of course. But here's the bottom line, though, George, that you and I are crazy, right? Because we're looking at this, and by the mainstream, you know, the theories that we're proposing, even though they're crystal clear, and anyone with a half a brain can recognize this, and to even argue this, you know, the only reason why it's being argued anyway is because, unfortunately, the great majority of mankind, scientists and religionists included, think that we are the pinnacle of creation, that, you know, evolutionary, technological evolution, or even, you know, spiritual evolution or development has experienced a gradual evolution from point A to point B, from point B to point C, from bottom to top, and we are at the pinnacle. We're the greatest, we're the crown of creation, we're absolutely incredible. I mean, all we're doing, we're navel-gazing. We're the best, we're the greatest, we're amazing. Yet, you know, everything is cyclical, that what we're experiencing today is nothing else what's been going on for thousands of years. And, you know, it's an absolute blasphemy to suggest that a technology such as nuclear power, or at least atomic bombs, existed thousands of years ago, and we have physical evidence for this.
Now, tell me about this giant crater found just outside of Mumbai in India.
Right. I mean, I'm glad you bring that up, because, you know, that is basically, you know, it's called the Lonar Crater, which is located 400 kilometers northeast of Mumbai, and it's dated less than 50,000 years old, and it's this nearly circular 2,100-meter diameter crater.
It's so huge.
It's huge, almost perfect.
And no remnants of an asteroid?
Nothing. No. And that is exactly what I was getting at, because the only way, and see, at the center of this structure or of this crater, we have these basalt glass spheres that could have only been created if that area had been exposed to high, high degrees of heat. And no volcanoes in the area, by the way.
No.
And no meteorite. So, I mean, you know, nature can do amazing things. But at the same time, you know, sometimes you also have to go with logic. And if nature by herself cannot create something like this, well, then there's only one solution to this, and that is some type of an outside force besides nature created this, or, you know, had the effect of creating something like this.
Now, I'm going to ask you to speculate, because that's what this is, but I'm just curious to get your take, because I'm sure you've tried to think, what happened? What went? What occurred? Why was there a battle?
Well, I mean, you see, here is the thing that, you know, I sort of disagree with in the whole alternative history field, and that is, you know, a lot of people, you know, especially UFO people, they're always not. And of course, I'm generalizing, George. I'm not saying that everyone is like this, but in general, everyone says that the moment that, you know, extraterrestrials show up in their UFOs, all of our problems will be solved, everything will be great, we'll have, you know, free energy, this and that. Now, while I think that that is possible, I am more of the conviction that, you know, how we have problems on this planet, there are problems out there. It's not all perfect out there. It's just a bigger version of everything that's going on here. There's good, and then there's evil. You know, everything, you know, good and evil penetrates or you know, encompasses the entire universe. And I'm also a believer that in the end, good outweighs the bad. However, so if we have those ancient texts where these battles are described, in my opinion, and, you know, in Zechariah Sitchin's opinion, Eric von Däniken, and all other sorts of ancient astronaut theorists, is that those extraterrestrials who came here, there is a possibility that they crash-landed. And so there were some types of mutinies going on where all of a sudden some people of the crew did no longer agreed with the commander, and so they start to have these factions and these battles started. And we have very concise references for this. I mean, one example, for example, is Lucifer. I mean, Lucifer was a part of quote-unquote God's crew, and I'm not saying that God was an extraterrestrial. But I am suggesting that whoever or whatever was described in the Old Testament Bible was not God in that sense, but a misunderstood flesh and blood extraterrestrial. And so those ancient texts that describe these battles are between these quote-unquote gods that are fighting between each other. And just to be clear, whenever I say gods, and I know you agree with me on that one, it's always lowercase g.
Yes, sir.
It has nothing to do with, you know, capital G God. And so, you know, it is amazing that in ancient India, especially now that we're talking about these atomic explosions, were you aware that whenever these weapons of this incredible force, whenever they were deployed, they were always hurled from these flying machines called Vimanas, and we have these concise descriptions of flying chariots in ancient Indian texts that were piloted by the gods. And still today, in the Hindi language, the word Viman means airplane. So we have a surviving mythology in language that has survived to this day.
Absolutely. Now, there's a British researcher. His name, of Indian origin, David Davenport.
Mm-hmm.
He spent at least 12 years studying ancient Hindu scripts, and he concludes that there was this atomic explosion 4,000 years ago?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a very interesting point here. In 1975, David Davenport published a book in India. He lived in India, but he published a book in Italy, and the title was 2000 Anticristo Distruzione Atomica, which in English means Atomic Destruction in 2000 BC. And in that book, Davenport claimed to have proof that Mohenjo-Daro, one of the oldest cities in the world of human civilization, had been destroyed by an atomic bomb. And what he basically proposed was that, you know, and he basically just addressed mainstream archaeologists, because at Mohenjo-Daro we have thousands of these glassy lumps, which are called the black stones, and they turn out to be fragments of clay vessels which had melted into each other in some type of an extreme heat. And that extreme heat, he proposes, was about 2,000 degrees centigrade, which is about 3,600 degrees Fahrenheit. And when they got down to the levels of the skeletons of the people that died right there at Mohenjo-Daro, all of those people just lied there, unburied, hand in hand sometimes.
Like Nagasaki, like Hiroshima.
See, this is why I love talking to you, George. Exactly. Exactly. And in fact, you know, one Soviet professor, or Russian, sorry about that, one Russian scholar back in the day when it was still the Soviet Union, actually did research there, and they determined that one of the skeletons had a radiation level 50 times greater than normal. Now, this is all very wild stuff, and nobody talks about it.
This is incredible, truly incredible work. Is he still alive, do you know?
That, unfortunately, I'm not aware. I don't know. I don't know.
He would be a great one for your History Channel shows.
Yeah, absolutely.
If he's still
for sure
out there. We'll do some checking. Both of us will.
Wonderful.
There's another expert out there by the name of William Sturm, and I think he is still alive. He has said that the melting bricks at this town you just mentioned,
mm-hmm.
How do you pronounce that?
Mohenjo-Daro.
Mohenjo-Daro could not have been caused. The melting bricks, he said, could not have been caused by a normal fire.
No, and Mohenjo-Daro is not the only place. We have also in Saudi Arabia, we have a site that has these spherules. We have that in the Sinai Peninsula. I mean, you know, today's Israel, so, you know, can you say Sodom and Gomorrah? I mean, there we have
Perfect.
A biblical story that possibly describes some type of a atomic bomb that went off that, you know, made Lot's wife turn into a pillar of salt. I mean, again, those stories, of course, are stories. They're legends. But what I'm after is the core. What compelled our ancestors to put this in writing, or at least put it in their oral traditions? Because they most certainly did not just sit around a campfire and, you know, got drunk or were smoking dope, and then all of a sudden they're like, all right, well, what should we come up with tonight? No. What they wrote down and what they put in their oral traditions, it was their history. Just like today, we put stuff in the newspaper that really is going on. And to suggest that everything our ancestors, you know, wrote down on paper is nothing but fantasy. You know, who is insulting whom here? The mainstream scientists are insulting me and are saying that Eric and I and Zachariah Sitchin, that we are insulting our ancestors. But are we really? I don't think so, because the mainstream scientists are saying, in fact, that everything that we read in ancient times, oh, we have to take it with a grain of salt, because our ancestors just didn't get it. So everything was just divine, and everything had to do with the gods, and they did not exist. And it was just a way of coming to grips with the world. Now, that to me, that is the slap in our ancestors' face.
And you've heard the stories of, in the deserts of the Middle East, they see glass down as if it was created was some kind of atomic explosion.
And that is what I'm actually referring to about Saudi Arabia. Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So, and none of that stuff could happen by the sunlight alone, because, you know, both you and I have been in the desert. It's incredibly hot. I mean, it's crazy. You just want to lay down and sleep. I mean, it is very hot.
It's hot, but you're not going to make glass.
Exactly. And again, you know, in the desert, you don't necessarily have volcanic activity. So the only way that could have been possible is it was some type of a blast, or at least some technology that has been lost ever since.
Well, Michael Cremo, in his Forbidden Archaeology, talks about humankind being millions and millions of years old. And who knows what kind of technology we could have had. Though I think, Giorgio, you and I subscribe to the ancient astronaut theory. It is possible that we had intelligence on this planet that was humankind, and they blew themselves up as well.
Like we're about to?
Like we could.
I don't mean to
sound that was kind of scary the way you said that.
Well, you know, I mean, look, I'm always a guy that says that the glass is half full instead of half empty. But, you know, there are so many bizarre thinking people out there right now who unfortunately believe strongly. And I mean the word believe, not that they know. They believe it. There's faith involved about the end times. And that really concerns me, because there's people in power who believe in the end times. And I think that's very disconcerting because, you know, for example, the Maya never said that the world will end in 2012. They never said that.
Never.
So we should just get away from that. The world will go on. Everything will be fine because, you know, this is not the end. So we should get away from this doom and gloom idea of 2012.
Giorgio, when we come back, I want to talk with you about your latest work of ancient dragon myths and China folklore and Native American thunderbirds as well. Plus, go up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Giorgio has sent us a few images I want you to look at before we talk about it next hour on Coast to Coast AM. Giorgio Tsoukalos, our special guest tonight. Giorgio, tell me about what you've been studying about ancient dragon myths and China's folklore and Native American thunderbirds. I remember you talking about that when you were with me when you were taping the History Channel's Ancient Aliens. Let's get into that.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is all quite fascinating, because if you look at the ancient myths of China, but also the Native American stories, the Chinese folklore or traditions, they refer to these dragons. And Native American traditions refer to the thunderbirds. And, you know, coming from the ancient astronaut perspective, I've always asked myself, you know, did the ancient Chinese, did the Native Americans really truly mean that biological entities such as dragons or thunderbirds existed in real life? And I've pretty much come to the conclusion that, once again, that is not necessarily the case, but that what we have here is another example of misunderstood technology. Now, mind you, I'm not the first to have come to this conclusion. In 1928, the American writer by the name of Berthold Laufer, wrote a book by the name of with the title "The Prehistory of Aviation," and in it there were a whole bunch of bizarre wood carvings that he saw or that he was able to look at when he visited China back in the day. And what surprised the author, and he was, by the way, he was also an anthropologist, so he was not just some tourist of or something like this. I mean, he was a scientist. He was surprised that in all of these wood carvings that he saw in China, that there were all these very bizarre carvings of flying chariots that mm-hmm. were drawn by dragons. And along with the texts that, you know, go along with these carvings, you know, these dragons were always described to arrive with a lot of noise and thunder and smoke, and the earth was trembling. And then the moment those dragons, quote unquote, landed on the ground with their iron feet, out of their mouth or sometimes out of their belly, the first Chinese emperors came out. So, and they were always known as the divine rulers from the sky, the divine sky rulers, or the teachers from heaven. So if you look at the same story in Native American myths, you have these references of the thunderbirds.
What we think are the big birds, right?
Exactly, exactly. And mind you, while, you know, I will not, you know, go ahead and knock cryptozoology, I mean, we don't know if any of those big birds truly exist.
Right, or maybe they're pterosaurs. Who knows?
Exactly. However, if I have stories in Native American myth where these thunderbirds are described to come out of the deep, dark void, which in my opinion is another description for deep space, or sometimes referred to as the deep coldness or the deep emptiness or something like this. And then these thunderbirds descended in this big, you know, amount of noise and smoke and the earth trembling again. And then out of their beak, they lowered their beak, and out of those beaks came what's called the kachinas, the heavenly teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all have seen kachinas. If you go to any type of, you know, Native American souvenir shop, there are these wonderfully carved figures, many of which have an animal character to them. But some of them, if you look closely, they're wearing helmets, they have wings, they have these visors, very bizarre, you know, renditions
extremely
of these beings. And if you ask the Native Americans, they will tell you that the Kachinas were, in fact, star people, and that those star people manifested themselves and then taught mankind in various disciplines. Now, when I hear the word manifested, then personally, I don't believe that those people came out of nowhere or those Kachinas came out of the spiritual realm. But let's say they arrived in those quote-unquote thunderbirds. People were unable to see them right away, but they then manifested themselves the moment that thunderbird opened its beak and they were able to walk out of it. Now, the thunderbird, in the ancient astronaut opinion, was some type of a vehicle with which they were able to travel from, you know, from one place to the other. And so we have all these different references where, you know, these thunderbirds are also sometimes referred to as being made of metal. And so were those dragons. And by the way, the Chinese traditions and the Native American traditions are not the only ones that speak of dragons or some type of flying birds. Even in ancient Greece, which obviously, you know, is a much younger culture than China, however, around the island of Crete, there was a monster that was gleaming off with a bronze impenetrable skin. And anyone who has read the Argonautica with Jason and the Argonauts,
sure, yeah.
I mean, that thing, that quote-unquote monster, was protecting the island of Crete. And the only way to conquer the monster is if you went down to its heel and you sort of unplugged this this screw or this mallet made of bronze or gold. And the moment that screw was removed, this oozing black liquid, thick liquid, removed the blood of the monster. And only then were you able to conquer the monster, because due to the lack of this liquid, all of its joints started to, you know, lock up. Now, can you say oil? Or can you say some type of a hydraulic system?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because obviously our ancestors, once again, and I cannot repeat myself with this enough, but our ancestors were highly intelligent, but their technological frame of reference was different than what we have today. So they had to describe it with the words and with the vocabulary that were at their disposal. So obviously, some type of a machine got turned into a monster, something out of this world.
Oh, if they had seen a submarine emerge,
exactly.
What do you think they would have said?
They would have said Jonah and the whale.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Jonah was most certainly not swallowed by a whale.
That's a good point.
You know, because...
These events happened,
yes,
but not the way they said.
Right. I mean, there's always... And this is why we live in such magnificent times right now, because we can look at these ancient texts from a modern perspective and recognize that stuff that we have today existed in one form or the other a long time ago.
You have sent us a couple pictures of massive monoliths that we've got posted at coasttocoastam.com. Mm-hmm. Explain these to us.
Well, the black and white picture that we have on coasttocoastam.com right now is a picture that was taken in the 50s. Of Baalbek in Lebanon. And Baalbek is a very popular site in all of the alternative history field. And the reason why it's so popular is the fact that this is the site, well, this town was known as Heliopolis, where the sun god Baal was worshipped. And yes, the Romans later used this temple. It was one of the most magnificent temples that they ever had. However, even the Romans themselves said in their chronicles that they themselves stumbled upon the foundations of this temple way after this thing had been built in the remote past. And so if you look at this picture, the reason why I love it is because you have a tiny human being just leaning against the second level of stones. And then the third level above that human being, you see a massive, massive megalithic slab where, you know, something like this, and I'm going to say it, George, we could not do today with none of our equipment. Because, you know, now today on the National Geographic Channel and all those wonderful channels, you see, you know, all this, you know, what do you call it, mega builders or engineers, how they recreate stuff and they're transporting big blocks of stone or big blocks of steel and all of this. But the stones we have at Baalbek, especially what we see in this picture, we would have difficulties, if not impossible, to transport this from place A to place B. And this here is thousands of years old, and our ancestors allegedly did this with ropes, pulleys, and with wooden rollers. And I say, whoever suggests something like this is retarded. and you know, I have no compunction of saying that.
Don't hold back, George.
Oh, I won't. I'm on a roll now. No, but the thing is, you know, the bottom line is, and you know, I would like to just go ahead and talk about the second picture that we have on coasttocoastam.com.
This is a strange one.
It is very much so. And the reason why I said that, you know, anyone who suggests that our ancients were able to do this with you know, chiseled technology is retarded.
Primitive tools.
With primitive tools is retarded because for Ancient Aliens, the series, which will air in April, and we're all looking forward to it, and I hope everyone will tune in on the History Channel in April, we actually had the privilege, because there is something I wanted to do the first time around, and due to time constraints, we couldn't do it, but this time, we were able to do it for the series, and that is, I wanted to go and talk to a real-life stone cutter, a real-life stonemason who, you know, cuts stones for a living.
Yeah, yeah.
And we actually had the privilege
with good tools.
Exactly. And we had the privilege of doing this about 6-7 weeks ago. And so not only did we see what it takes today to cut a piece of granite, I mean, all I can tell you is it's very powerful, it's very loud, and it takes hours, okay? But we also, you know, brought him pictures such as this one. And this carving of the stone block, especially I'm referring to the light gray stone block on the right, this can be found at my favorite site in the world, Pumapunku, in the highland of Bolivia, in the Andes, on the border of Peru and Bolivia, where Lake Titicaca connects the two countries.
It's one of Eric's good ones, too, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And in fact, Twilight of the Gods, the new book that will be published, will have an entire section of that.
Beautiful.
And what we have here, while it doesn't look impressive size-wise, from a stone-cutting perspective, when I showed this to the stone-cutter, he pretty much told me, Giorgio, please put this away. This is giving me a headache. Because he then also proceeded to say that today we could only do this with precision computer technology. And, you know, the mainstream says, the mainstream archaeologists are saying that we did this, or our ancestors did this. They carved this, allegedly, with chicken bones and with obsidian. Now, what we have here is diorite. Diorite is an extremely hard igneous rock, and I'm sorry, it doesn't work with chicken bones and with diorite. And you see, when you have especially the little square at the bottom that's the deepest, you can't cut that out, because the question that the stonecutter had is, how do you release the back of that rectangle or that square? You can't.
No, you can't at all. Why this planet, Giorgio? Why come here? Or do you think this was a mission of these ETs and they just went to as many Earth-like planets as they could find?
Thank you very much. That would have been exactly my answer, because, you know, obviously in our quadrant, you know, our planet would stick out like a sore thumb. However, that does not mean that Earth is unique, that we're the only planet in our galaxy that is inhabited. I mean, you know, just to, you know, revive Carl Sagan, billions of and billions of galaxies are out there, billions and billions of stars, each of which has planetary systems. I mean, to suggest that we're the only ones, which some scientists do, It defies logic. So, were they here? Absolutely. Did they also visit other planets? 100%. Because just like, you know, all the stuff that we've seen, and I know it's a human creation, but, you know, the worlds or the ideas behind Star Wars or Star Trek, I really think that the creators of those stories, Roddenberry and Lucas, they were onto something, that just like everything exists the way it does here on Earth, different races, different species, different everything, it exists out there. And some of them get along, some of them don't. And we're just this part of a bigger picture. And one day, hopefully, we'll have the privilege to join that big intergalactic club that's out there. It's not a right, by the way. It's a privilege. Because right now we're a very, very dangerous planet, and you know, I doubt that they want any official participation of us in that club out there because we're too violent.
Do you think the ETs that we're talking about are the alien grays or the Nordics that look like us, or we look like them?
It could be all of them. You see, I don't think that we were visited by just one species, but multiple. And, you know, your very last question right there is, do we look like them, is a resounding yes. Because, you see, the question is not, you know, what do the extraterrestrials look like?
And you pull out Genesis, in God's image.
Exactly. So if extraterrestrials, you know, quote-unquote, created us in their image, wouldn't that lead to the conclusion that who cares what the aliens look like? The bottom line is, the question that we should ask is, do we look like the aliens?
I want you to address this one for just a second, Giorgio, and that would be so many people who are staunch believers in the word of the Bible, mm-hmm. by the word, and, you know, they're hearing this tonight. I want you to temper that, because you've said time and time again, you believe in God.
Absolutely.
So explain that for me. Their belief in the Bible and the fact that it does not negate what you've been working on, and vice versa.
Right, because, you see, what we're working on is essentially to prove the point that not only have we been visited by extraterrestrials in the remote past, but that would inherently mean that the entire universe, or at least our galaxy, that there's at least one other species out there. Now, to me, that is a wonderful, wonderful thought in regards to religion, because it essentially means that God's creation was way bigger, way more magnificent than if, you know, God would have only created life on Earth. I mean, if we're truly, as some scientists and some religionists believe, if we're the only species in the entire galaxy, even in the entire universe, that to me would be an insult in the face of God's great creation, because it means that God essentially was only able to create us, and that is not very flattering.
We'll get your take when we come back, Giorgio, on the Ark of the Covenant and what you think it might be. And then next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Giorgio Tsoukalos right here on Coast to Coast AM. Giorgio, the Ark of the Covenant. You've got some interesting things to say about this.
Yes. And my question is it actually possible whether or not the Ark of the Covenant is of alien origin?
Why would you think that?
Well, because there are multiple references in the Bible that essentially describe that, you know, the ark was needed to transport something. And according to popular belief, it was the tablets of Moses that were transported in it. However, if you look at the apocryphal texts, which used to belong to the Bible but are no longer part of the Bible since the Council of Nicaea, and also some of the ancient Hebrew texts, what we find there, especially in the Zohar, in what is a part of the Kabbalah, we have a description of what's referred to as the Ancient of Days. And the Ancient of Days, you know, in popular idea, is thought to be a description of God. But back in the 70s, these two electrical engineers by the name of George Sassoon and Rodney Dale, they came to the conclusion that the Ancient of Days wasn't necessarily a description of God, but it was a description of some type of a machine. And this machine, the Ancient Days, correctly translated into English, would be the transportable one with the tanks. What tanks? What is described here? So they looked at this thing, this creature that was truly described in the Zohar. And by the way, anyone can go out and you know, get a copy of the Zohar and read this. I mean, Gregory Mather's book, The Kabbalah Decoded, is one of the seminal works on the Zohar and the Kabbalah. And you read about this thing with, you know, different faces and different brains and clear beards with tubes that went from one brain to the other, and these arms, and then this bright light which, you know, forwarded this liquid inside, and then all of a sudden at night's end or in the morning you have what's referred to as the manna. And you know, out of this machine, out of these tanks, the priests were able to siphon off this manna. Because if we look at the manna story, that it came from heaven, quote unquote heaven, you know, the conventional ideas that it was the excretion of some insects, or it was the morning dew, or something like this. If you, you know, expose this to a little bit more scrutiny, none of those mundane explanations really hold water. So that is exactly what Sassoon and Dale were exploring. You know, what is it that is behind this manna? And so, to make a long story short, they then explained or suggested that the manna machine that they called this machine that produced the manna was stored inside the Ark of the Covenant, which then was transported all over the place.
That's fascinating.
And so, also in medieval texts like Wolfram von Eschenbach and his Parzival legend and all the Arthurian legends, the idea is that the reason why the Templars were so many years in Jerusalem, they were there primarily to find this Ark of the Covenant, to find the Ark and then to actually find the manna machine. And if we all look at Templar lore, they allegedly were in possession of what's called the Baphomet. And the Baphomet was this quote-unquote idol that they were accused of devil worship and, you know, wrong things that they never actually did. But that this Baphomet had these glowing red eyes, and anyone who came close to it, you know, started to have problems health-wise. And by the way, even the Ark of the Covenant, you know, there are descriptions in the Bible that some people who went close to the Ark of the Covenant who were not the initiates,
they got electrocuted or something,
and died. Some of them even lost their hair and lost their nails, and they had boils on their skin.
Sounds like radiation poisoning.
Thank you. And that is what Rodney, what Sassoon and Dale proposed, that this machine had a very, very small nuclear reactor inside of it. And I think that the Ark, there's two ideas. One, that it's hidden somewhere in Aksum, which is in Ethiopia, or
in a church, right?
Exactly. Right. Deep down in the ground, and only the guardian of that church is able to look at it. And by the way, all of these guardians, and it's a sort of a family tradition or a family job, all of them have eye problems after about 20 years, which is very interesting because they allegedly are allowed to look at the Ark, and then something happens to their eyes. I mean, it can be a genetic effect that runs in that family, or it could be something else that we don't know of. I mean, it's highly fascinating. Now, the other idea is that we all know the story, and all Coast to Coast listeners know this, about the infamous money pit on Oak Island.
Yes, in Canada, right?
Exactly, in Nova Scotia and Halifax. And there we have this bizarre borehole where, you know, for almost, for 100 years now, people have spent millions and millions of dollars to get to the bottom of this pit. And they've all failed miserably because of this ingenious flooding system that keeps on, you know, flooding the shafts. And, but what they've discovered is when they went down with endoscopic cameras is they found those boxes that are sort of the same size as is described, the size that the Ark of the Covenant was. And at one time, someone also determined that there were high levels of radiation down there. Now that, you know, let me perk up, because I was like, well, that is very fascinating. Now, one of the most eminent Ark of the Covenant researchers, Peter Feebog, actually was interviewed for Ancient Aliens, the series. So we're going to go into more detail about all of this when the series airs, and I can't wait to see what they've done with this.
Well, that is a fascinating possibility, Giorgio. It just adds to the puzzle, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And, you know, just the idea, I mean, if the Ark of the Covenant or the Mana Machine one day is recovered from the money pit, I mean, it's over. The ancient astronaut theory will be proven. And, you know, everyone else will say, okay, fantastic. I mean, that'll be us. But I predict that all the scientists will say, well, we knew it all along, but we couldn't say anything because, you know, we were at the university and we had to have, you know, we had to remain quiet. So that's the only thing that concerns me.
Tell me a little bit about the Golden Record. What is that?
Well, the Golden Record are basically these phonograph records which were included aboard both Voyager spacecraft, which were launched in 1977. Now, the reason why I'm fascinated about this is because not only did this record contain 55 greetings in all different kinds of languages of planet Earth, but also it contained pictures.
And it was like a map back to the planet, wasn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. And it was all made out of gold. And,
like,
you know,
was it like a CD?
Yeah, I mean, almost. I mean, it's actually like a regular one of those old records that we existed before the CD came along.
Yeah.
And it works with a stylus. And the way, and there are these drawings on that record with instructions of how this stylus or how this record would work. And they all did this with binary arithmetic because, you know, the correct time of one rotation of the record is 3.6 seconds, and they expressed this in a unit of time of 0.7 billionths of a second, which is the time period associated with fundamental transition of the hydrogen atom, which is constant throughout the entire universe. So whoever finds this should, big emphasis on should know this. So not only do we have these greetings on there, but we also have analog pictures. Now, one analog picture on there is of Egypt, the Red Sea, and the Sinai Peninsula and the Nile. Now, that to me is already very fascinating because, allegedly, that is where we made first contact in Sumerian times with the Anunnaki. Second, one of the languages that is recorded on both of these golden records on board the Voyager spacecraft or space probe is Sumerian. Now, both you and I and all of our listeners know Sumerian is a dead language. Why on earth would they include Sumerian on that record?
Because they used to know it.
Thank you very much. I mean, that is exactly it. So could that be a hidden way of, bringing out the message?
Maybe that's their way of saying welcome back.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Oh, and another thing that's very, very fascinating is that, you know, the record itself is electroplated with uranium-238, and, the half-life of uranium-238 decays in about 4.51 billion years. And so if you examine that record and you examine the decay of uranium-238, whoever discovers this can determine the elapsed time since this space probe, traveled into deep space. So, I mean, this is magnificent stuff. It's great that we've done this. I mean, I'm very excited about it.
Do you think aliens are here among us right now, Giorgio?
Aren't you one, George?
Well, you never know. Don't blow my cover.
Okay, it's just between you and me then. No one's listening. You know, Lord Martin Rees of he's an astronomer royal of the United Kingdom. He actually just recently said that aliens could be amongst us, and we may not even be able to recognize them. And my hat goes off to that guy, because he is absolutely right. Because he says that just as a chimpanzee can't understand quantum theory, it could be that these extraterrestrials are literally standing right in front of our eyes, and we can't recognize them. Now,
yes.
I don't mean that, you know, I'm looking at you or you're looking at me and I'm an extraterrestrial, but that literally those extraterrestrials could be invisible because of their technology or their, you know, advanced, you know, being. Because one thing is crystal clear, that while ants live on our planet, they have literally no idea that we exist. So that could be the same way with extraterrestrials, because just like they're way more advanced, I mean, we are more advanced than ants, so that could play out exactly the same way with extraterrestrials.
You know, all of this, as we get back to Eric von Däniken, I think ties in tremendously with the work you've been doing, both as the publisher of Legendary Times and also the Ancient Astronaut Research Center. So tell me about that center.
Well, the Center for Ancient Astronaut Research is an organization, a research society that Eric von Däniken and I founded on June 17th in 1998, so 12 years ago. And we're pretty much dedicated to determining whether or not extraterrestrials visited Earth in the remote past. And as such, we publish a magazine called Legendary Times, and it's the only magazine in the world to exclusively dedicate its pages to the ancient astronaut theory. And so all, you know, the who is who in ancient astronaut research, they all publish their latest stuff in the pages of Legendary Times magazine. I mean, you know, Eric von Däniken writes in almost every issue. I myself, of course, write in every issue. But we've also got David Childress, Jason Martel, you know, Zacharias Sitchin has submitted articles.
You've got some heavyweights in there, let me tell you.
You know, because the thing is that, you know, there has got to be some type of a voice that is dedicated to this specific research, because we will not delve into, you know, other areas of research like UFOs or modern UFOs. See, our UFOs happened thousands and thousands of years ago. That doesn't mean that we disagree with modern ufology, but, you know, we write about ancient astronauts. And by the way, anyone who goes to legendarytimes.com tonight and clicks on free info, if you fill out information, everyone will get a free issue tonight. And we'll send it to you, but please be patient, because
you get swamped.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I'm like an issue or two behind with publishing Legendary Times, but it's been such a tremendous, incredible year for me, which means, you know, a lot of people have expressed their interest in Legendary Times, but at the same time, I'm scrambling, so I ask for everyone's patience, please, because while it looks like we're a big organization, we're really not. It's a couple of people that do this. So, you know, I you know, I'm very appreciative of all my fans, all my subscribers, all the members of Legendary Times. I mean, it's them who keep this research going. And, you know, whenever people ask me, how can we get involved? What can we do to help you and Eric with your research? The answer is become a member. Become a member of Legendary Times and the Center for Ancient Astronaut Research, because, you know, that is the way how we fund our research. That is how we organize our expeditions and how we, you know, get all the materials together. And, you know, if you get the magazine, 64 pages, from first page to the last, it's all articles. There are no ads in there. It's all membership support. And you've seen issues, right? You're reading it, right? You enjoy it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Of everything you've investigated, which thing really just drives you crazy? Just is incredible.
Puma Punku. Every time Puma Punku is, in my opinion, is the smoking gun. While there are other areas that I find fascinating, the pyramids, the Nazca lines, you know, those are all great. However, Puma Punku, because when you go there, you shake your head, because all those stones, also what I didn't mention before, display or feature what's called vitrification, which is a occurrence that only happens if you heat up the stone to a very high temperature, and then the stone sort of melts, and then it hardens into place again, and then it has this surface as if it were a bathroom mirror. And so all the stones at Puma Punku feature exactly that. It's perfect.
Well, the story you told us about the atomic war, too, that mm-hmm. to me is absolutely staggering.
Yeah. No, and you know, again, the thing is that all these stories that we've talked about tonight, they happen or happened all over the world in every culture. It doesn't mean that, you know, none of this, for example, happened in, you know, none of this happened in Europe. Of course it did. Ancient Greece is filled with these stories. So are the Scandinavian countries, even in, you know, the English and Irish parts of the world, in honor of St. Patrick's Day today. You know, even that part of the world talked about legends of these weird, bizarre beings, the shining ones, who, according to those legends, came from the stars.
Absolutely. Well, Giorgio, you stay with us, because next hour we're going to take phone calls with you as we talk about ancient astronauts. And at the end of the program, Giorgio just mentioned St. Paddy's Day. At the end of the program, next hour, we will play Coast to Coast guest Christian Wilde's rendition of Danny Boy. You know, Christian, he's one of the best when it comes to health and health medicine ideas. And this is one thing that he does as a hobby that he loves, and he sings. And he's given us his CD, and we will play it in its entirety at the end of the hour. We'll be back in a moment with Giorgio Tsoukalos and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, let's go to some of the phones. Giorgio, are you ready?
Of course I am, yes.
All right, we'll go to Des Moines, Iowa to start things, east of the Rockies. April. Hello, April. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Giorgio. How are you?
Hi, April. I'm doing well. How about you?
Oh, all right. I'm sort of a little nervous and disturbed about some of the things that you're saying, but I find it rather interesting. I'm going to do a lot of research myself. But I was wondering if you've ever heard of an author. He wrote something called The Black Death, and he was talking about how some of the fields were being, like, sprayed down, and, like, the next day people would have, like, the Black Plague appear. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
I think that you're referring to William Bramley's theory?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, the ancient astronaut theorists are pretty much divided on Bramley's proposal that aliens were responsible for the Black Death, me included. But regardless of whether or not anyone agrees with him or not, I mean, his research does prove at least one thing, that UFOs absolutely were reported during the Middle Ages.
Right.
And that alone is extraordinary.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Thank you for all you're doing, and good night, George.
Good night. Thank you.
All right.
Appreciate you being on the show. Goodbye. Let's go to Anthony in Orange, California, first-time caller. Anthony, thanks for calling.
Hey, what's going on, George?
All is well.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for having a show like this, because, I mean, there's a bunch of shows that come, you know, like a dime a dozen, and they all pretty much all sound the same. But I've got to say, your show is like one of a kind, and I started listening to your show actually last week, and I've been hooked, and I just want to say thank you again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Giorgio, I was listening earlier. You said a book coming out called Twilight of the Gods.
Yes.
Now, how much more different is that from Chariots of the Gods?
Well, in its message, obviously, it'll be the same. It'll propose that Earth has been visited by extraterrestrials in the remote past, but that will be, you know, Eric's, I think it's his 29th or 30th book.
Well, he's talking about prolific.
Exactly.
Wow.
And he's 75. And so, you know, how will it be the same like Chariots of, or how similar will it be? Well, one thing that will most certainly be different is the fact that, you know, there will be way less stuff, if any stuff in there, that can be proven wrong. In fact, Eric von Däniken himself, when he wrote the foreword for the 35-year edition of Chariots of the Gods,
yeah,
he actually admitted that, you know, there were mistakes in the original Chariots of the Gods. Now, find me one other researcher, especially in the mainstream, who will say, yep, I made a mistake 40 years ago. It virtually does not exist. So the thing is that, you know, Eric, you know, one thing that nobody talks about is the fact that Chariots of the Gods not only had a question mark on the book cover, but in the book itself, there are over 200 question marks. So it's not like everything was stated as a matter of fact, but they were questions.
Right.
And so now, though, with Twilight of the Gods, I mean, I've read the German version twice now, and I'm working on, you know, Twilight of the Gods as being one of the editors. You know, there aren't that many mistakes there anymore, and I think it's wonderful because, you know, science has changed, new evidence has come along, mm-hmm. and some of the stuff that is being will be presented in that book is completely irrefutable.
And when can we expect this book to come out?
Later on in the year, starting in July or August. By, I definitely know the publisher. It's Career Press, New Page Books, and the same guys that published History is Wrong, and they're a wonderful publishing house. And obviously, the moment that the book becomes available, we'll have it available for sale at legendarytimesbooks.com.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. Hey, George,
yeah.
You've got a loyal listener from now on.
Absolutely. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
That's how you build. Thank you, Giorgio, by the way. Let's go to Spokane, Washington. Ross on the wild card line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Ross.
Hey, George. It's an honor to speak with you.
Likewise.
My question for you, Giorgio, is have you ever encountered any, you know, ancient alien abduction type stories or anything like that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, there are lots of them, actually. I mean, if you look at the story of Ezekiel, if you look at the book of Enoch, if you look at the apocalypse of Abraham, if you look at the apocalypse of Baruch, they were all taken up. They were all taken up, an ascension of some kind in a fiery chariot or in the glory of the Lord. And, you know, according to the ancient astronaut theory, the glory of the Lord, or, you know, those fiery chariots weren't necessarily, you know, figments of their imagination, or that these people weren't necessarily experiencing a vision in their minds, but that were actual physical events where those biblical figures were taken up in some type of a machine, in some type of a spaceship, a vehicle, a vimana, what have you, because whenever they arrived, wherever they were going, they explained in very great detail that, you know, all of a sudden they were in a new world, that a big house with like a palace with white walls. And on those walls, there were all these different jewels, and everything was blinking and glistening and just shiny like a sea of jewels. Now, if you ever boarded a plane and you look to the left and you look at inside the flight deck, you have all these different controls and these blinking lights. Now, somebody who doesn't know what that is or who has never seen something like that before, the best way to describe something like that is this treasure chest of gold and jewels. We also have to remember that our ancestors tried to describe something with words that were at their disposal at the time. So we have not only those descriptions of these shining lights on the walls and these glowing stones, these glowing magical tablets, but also whenever they got there, you know, the people that they were surrounded by spoke a different language. They didn't understand who they were. And also, you know, they were always brought to the highest of the highest. And, you know, they were taught in, for example, Enoch was given this tool, this fast writing tool. It was sort of like a reed. And all of a sudden, Enoch was able to write extremely fast. Now, my question is, what was that magical tool, that magical reed that Enoch had in his hands with which he was able to write? So there are countless of descriptions like that. And I mentioned this, I think, in my last appearance on Coast to Coast, but one of the most fascinating stories is the Apocalypse of Abraham, where he also is described. And by the way, all those books are used to be, like I mentioned before, a part of the Bible, but they were taken out later in the Councils of Nicaea because they were deemed too dangerous. They contained too much information. And
I wonder, you know, would they be allowed today?
Oh, you can go buy them. You can buy them at any – well, no, you don't have to even buy them. You can just go to the library or online. And
there they are.
And there they are. I mean, they're obviously reprints, but they're called the Apocrypha.
Okay.
And the Apocalypse of Abraham describes Abraham being taken up by the quote-unquote Lord, lowercase L. When he got to this new place – he got very sick because he describes that he was standing at a window and he saw his world down below, which was Earth, in a sea of black, by the way, he describes it. And then it was as if I was falling down towards Earth, and then Earth appeared again at the top. And then I fell down again and Earth appeared again at the top. And he was standing at a window describing this. So that is, from a modern perspective, a description of artificial gravity. If that was a wheel in space that was turning on its own axis, that is exactly what you would see if you were to stand in front of a window in an orbiting city in space.
Okay, back to the phones. Mary in Independence, Missouri. Go ahead, Mary. You're up with us.
Oh, thank you, George, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And hello, Giorgio. I have a couple of things to ask. But first of all, George, there's four of us in my family that have seen the UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'd like to know, Giorgio, what do you think about the airstrip down in South America? And with a thunderbird, and also I think that was a spider. And the only way you could see that is from the air. And also about the crystal skulls that have been taken away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. To me, my theory is all this is connected. And I like to know, Giorgio, what do you think? And thank you. I'll take my answer off the
Okay. Go ahead, Georgie.
Thanks. Thanks so much for your call. And this, we're all confusing the Giorgio and George and everything.
Too
so
many of us.
But, you know, thank you very much for this call, because you just mentioned something very important when you said that, you know, you think that everything is connected. And that is completely true, because, of course, everything is all connected. And that is the beauty of the ancient astronaut theory, that we look at all fields of science, all fields of, you know, archaeology, whether it be, you know, Egyptology, or if it's, you know, ancient, you know, South American studies or African studies. Doesn't matter. It's all under the same umbrella for us. And we try to draw these comparisons and these correlations because, yes, the airstrip you're referring to is in Peru, and they're essentially the Nazca lines. And mind you, no one in the ancient astronaut theory has ever suggested that they were landing strips. I mean, the only thing we've ever said was that seen from the air, which is the only way, by the way, you can see them, is that all of this really looks like airstrips. I mean, they truly do look like airstrips because it's just like this giant airfield with these landing strips that look like landing strips. And then you have the figures, like you mentioned, the spider, but you also have a whale, you have a hummingbird, you have, another being that's called the El Astronauta, the astronaut, with one hand pointing down to Earth and one hand pointing to the sky. And so there's all these bizarre geoglyphs that are huge. I mean, some of these lines and these bands go for as long as 23 kilometers over valleys and mountains. But the most significant thing at Nazca, for sure, are the areas where entire mountaintops have just been removed and flattened. It's as if somebody took a cheese knife and just shaved the mountaintop off because the surrounding mountains converge at the summit, and there are two mountains at Nazca where the summit is missing, and clearly, and anyone can look at the pictures, the mountaintops have been removed, flattened. And as far as the crystal skulls are concerned, all I have to say on that topic is the fact that we today, in modern computer technology, are using crystals for information storage. So is it possible that the crystal skulls, 13 of which allegedly exist on or have been deposited on planet Earth, contain information? The possibility most certainly is there.
Well, that's true. How windy is it up there on the Nazca Plateau?
Very. And that actually, is expressed that whenever something actually grows there, it's only in shrub form, including trees. I mean, if a tree grows there, it's very stunted. So it can get very windy there. Of course, it can. Obviously, it's a desert. It can get very, very hot, very, very cold at night. So it's quite an arid and hostile environment.
With Eric von Däniken's theories, when you first heard them, what did you think?
I thought that is what adventure should be like, because I was always interested in archaeology, but, looking at a shard of pottery to me is not very exciting. But if I get big walls, big geoglyphs, megalithic structures, the bigger the better, where you can't even put a dollar bill in between the fittings in some cases, that is exciting. That's excitement to me. Because, it just gets my mind going. How was this possible, especially in light of the fact that we ourselves today, with our modern technology, would have a hard time recreating this?
Absolutely. Let's go to Paul in British Columbia. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi. I love the show. Fantastic.
Thanks.
I just got two quick comments, and then I'll get off the air. My first comment is in Vancouver at UBC, they did a study where they actually reduplicated the Ark of the Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of using gold, they used copper.
Mm.
And what they found was they found that, like the Levites, if they were carrying the Ark of the Covenant, they exposed it to similar situations like heat, and it naturally conducted static electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And it conducted so much static electricity that it caught on fire. The acacia wood and everything that was underneath the copper actually caught on fire.
Uh-huh.
So just, the thought that people think that it's from outer space. Well, if it conducted a lot of natural static electricity, if somebody touches it, of course, they'd lose their hair or they'd lose their nails. And then my second comment was some people, they believe that the Ark of the Covenant is in Ethiopia. But I've heard that they had an archaeological dig in Israel near the Wailing Wall led by Rabbi Getz in 1981. And they believe that the Ark of the Covenant is actually there underneath. And it was buried there by King Josiah when the Babylons mm-hmm. Destroyed the temple in 564 BC. And the Israeli government knows of it. They're not willing to let it out, because if the Israelis were to find out that the Ark of the Covenant is actually tangible and there, then they might incite World War III, because they'd like to build the temple. And the Muslims, they have the Temple Mount there, which would be controversial.
Well, that entire area, thanks for your comments, that entire area, Giorgio, I think is worthy of major investigation and excavation, as they continue to do. We find things about that area, cities, you name it. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, let's go back now to final calls. We'll pick it up by going to Seaback, Washington, west of the Rockies. Ed's with us. Hey, Ed.
George. Hi, Giorgio.
Hi.
My question for you, Giorgio, is the ancient nuclear war you were speaking of, do you suppose that it may have played a factor in the burning of the Alexandrian Library? I'll take your response up there.
Well, that's an interesting question, Giorgio.
That is a very interesting question. And, you know, I would have to ruminate about this question a little bit longer, but my quick answer would be no, but it was other factors who contributed to the burning of the Alexandria Library, just like with any other libraries that have been burned down, including, you know, the ancient Mayan papyruses and codices that we've had, that they were always burnt and destroyed in some type of an ideology, which is very unfortunate. Lots and lots and lots of knowledge has been lost over the millennia because of very, very unfortunate decisions by mankind.
The fire was in 48 BC.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also was subjected to attacks and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But can you imagine some of the things that might have been in there?
Oh, wow. I'd be out of a job. But, yes, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, because, you see, our ancestors were extremely prolific and very meticulous in writing this stuff down. And so for all that to get lost to the flames of fires, I mean, that is truly, truly unfortunate.
Next up, we go to Lima, Ohio. Jerry, you're up with us. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, George. Yeah, it's Lima.
Lima, that's
Lima
right.
Lima bean.
Lima.
Hey, yeah. My question just absolutely evaporated as soon as it started ringing. So this is all I want to say. I read Von Däniken back in the 70s, and I believe that if he's not the founder of modern ufology, he's one of them. And up until the last couple of years, he's got no respect. I mean, he did the groundbreaking work. He did the photos. And if it wasn't for him, a lot of people that's getting doctors now wouldn't know the first thing about ufology.
Would you agree with that, Giorgio? He's not getting the kind of respect? Thanks, Jerry.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Jerry. I mean, I'm actually torn with that assessment, and I can actually speak for Eric that he would be torn as well, because if you look at something like the History Channel show Ancient Aliens, I mean, you know, we all, including Eric, were very well shown respect in that show. Now, in newspapers, in scientific textbooks, university textbooks, is Eric shown respect? Absolutely not. But, you know, here's the thing. If you look at a science textbook of, let's say, 100 years ago, 99% of that knowledge, and I'm, of course, overgeneralizing, but 99% of that knowledge contained in that textbook is today obsolete. Now, even though at the time when that book was published 100 years ago, that knowledge was cutting edge. So I'll make one prediction.
that 100 years from now, there will only be a few theories that will still hold true. And one of them will be the ancient astronaut theory. And one of the, founders or the biggest proponent was, or most known proponent was Eric von Daniken. So respect will come. I wouldn't worry about it.
Let us hope.
Yes.
Next up, we go to Redwood City, California. Rob, you're up with us. Hello, Robbie.
Hi, George and Giorgio.
Hi.
I have a question about the Mayan civilization. I went to Guatemala in 98.
Mm-hmm.
And in Tikal, in Petén, there wasn't as many monoliths as we found down in Sabal and other obscure sites. Mm-hmm. And the monoliths that I saw down there and took photos of down there are very much astronaut-like type images.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But
in fact,
my question is, modern scholars are saying the Mayan civilization only goes back to maybe 2000 BC. Where's the disconnect?
I wouldn't even. I don't even think that they say 2000 BC. I mean, they're according to the mainstream archaeology, their peak was around 300 to 600 AD. So, you know, the 2000 BC, I don't think any mainstream scientists would even suggest that. I mean, not their peak period, at least.
Right.
But you're absolutely correct that many of those steles and those carvings that we find, I mean, especially at the outdoor museum at Tikal, one stele has been found there where, there is this thing that's on in the front of this being that wears some type of a suit. The boots are surrounded by some type of tubing. The hands are, enclosed in mittens, also with some type of mechanical devices around the wrists. And then in the front of the body, of the torso, there is this tube, this pipe that goes from the top of the chest all the way down, and then it sort of bends around the hips and then goes to some type of a tank. Now, the mainstream archaeologists, they call this the spine. But anyone that has a spine like that really should go and see a chiropractor, because you couldn't even walk like that.
Giorgio, tell us a little bit more about the History Channel's five-part series on ancient aliens and astronauts.
Yes, no, absolutely. And, first of all, you and I will be on it, so everyone should definitely tune in.
You mean I didn't make the editing room floor?
Of course not. Are you kidding me? No, of course. You did great the first time around, and I'm really delighted, and it's a privilege to have you back on the program for the series. And so there will be five episodes, all of which will be aired sometime in April, Ancient Aliens, the series on the History Channel, two-hour episodes. So there will be, at least 95 minutes of content, which means we'll really have an opportunity to delve deeply into the subject matter and, all of the notables of the ancient astronaut theory are once again part of the program. And, even some of the scientists that were a part of the show for the first time around have come back, which means they actually enjoyed the way the ancient alien theory was presented. And if you have a scientist who at the end says that, listen, if the ancient astronaut theory is proven to be right, that will be a huge boon for my field of science in general, because it means they're close by. Now, if you have a quote-unquote debunker saying something like that, that is huge. It's a very positive change in the right direction.
Albany, Oregon, first-time caller, Chuck. Hi, Chuck.
Howdy. How are you, George?
Okay, all is well. Thanks.
Well, good. I'm really enjoying the show tonight. My question for your guest, and I'll take my answer off the phone.
All right.
Has he found, in any of his research, any sort of tie-in between the ancient aliens, ancient astronauts, and like a precursor human civilization like Atlantis? And then is there any sort of thought, anything, to the possibility that what we're actually seeing or may have seen aren't necessarily ETs, but people from the future, humans, going back and basically visiting and fixing problems?
Good theory. I've heard it before, Giorgio.
Yeah, and I actually would like to answer the second part of the question first, because that is exactly one of the questions that me and David Childress and Eric von Daniken that were asked the most, whether or not those ancient aliens aren't necessarily ancient aliens, but they're us from the future. And there is a very simple answer to that, and some people might disagree, but some people might agree. But the bottom line is that everything in life comes down to energy. And in order to perform or conduct time travel, you need a crap load of energy. And so to make a long story short, time travel per se, going into the past, theoretically speaking, is possible. However, we're, of course, hundreds, if not thousands of years away from actually building a machine with which we're able to actually time travel. So what physicists have suggested, or not suggested, but they've actually proven it, that the energy requirements to power a time machine are infinitely larger than what we would need to power a spaceship with which to travel from star to star. So from a logical perspective, we will first succeed in traveling to a distant star or a planetary system before we will succeed in time traveling. Now, that does not mean that I'm saying that time travel is not possible. Of course it is, or it already has been, one way or the other. But from a energy requirement perspective, we will first explore the galaxy in spaceships before we will visit ourselves in the past, due to the simple fact that the energy requirements to power a time machine are infinitely larger than to power a spaceship.
Giorgio, have you dealt with at all the Dogon tribe and their serious mystery of the Sirius star system?
Oh, of course. And we've actually just written a big article about this in Legendary Times.
Right.
And, you know, there are so many people who have suggested that, you know, the whole idea that the Dogon knew about the Sirius A and the Sirius B constellations is nothing but a hoax, that it was they were infiltrated, and that knowledge was given to them by some ethnologists that, you know, visited the tribe.
The French explorers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, that really, if you dig deeper, can't be true, because the Dogon have a festival. It's called the Rice Festival, the Sigi Festival, that they celebrate every 50 to 52 years, and that coincides exactly with an orbit of that invisible companion star that they said existed, which, by the way, years later then was indeed confirmed by modern astronomy with our modern instruments. And they celebrate this festival that celebrates the orbit of the star with these wonderful, wonderful, beautiful carved masks made out of wood. And these masks have been tested, and they go back at least 1,000 years.
And how about ancient drawings, you know, pictures that depict UFOs in the background, caves that depict astronauts and visitors? All that's fascinating.
All around the world this stuff exists.
Yes.
And that is why, you know, you can't explain this stuff away with fantasy or a figment of the imagination, because for every fantasy story that you create, there had to have been some real spark of inspiration, something real. And to say that, you know, oh, all these ancient descriptions of these gods or these teachers from heaven are nothing else but, you know, natural occurrences like rain, thunder, earthquakes, well, you know, or wind. I've never been talked to by wind and rain, but these ancient texts always speak that these, you know, occurrences that they were talked to, and that these events happened in a physical, you know, quote-unquote divine form. So it wasn't nature. It wasn't in their imagination of our ancestors that this stuff happened.
Well, there's no question, Giorgio, that something happened on this planet a long, long time ago, and something is probably happening on Earth-like planets throughout this universe. Who are these people? Are they messengers of God? Who knows what they may be? But there's no doubt something strange happened on planet Earth thousands and thousands of years ago. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.